Welcome to Game Store Profits, where we talk about God, gaming, and groups. I'm your host, Daniel Fisher, along here with the Zaffo Beeblebrox to my Ford Prefect, Mike Perna.
For once, I appreciate the reference.
Well, that's okay, because afterwards we'll have an intergalactic gargle blaster and forget all our problems.
Oh my goodness, I love the Hitchhiker's Guide. There's nothing about the Hitchhiker's Guide that I don't like.
It's one of my favorite books. I read it when I was probably 15, when I picked up the first book. And I knew I was going to marry my wife when I saw on her bookshelf in her apartment the entirety of the collection of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in one massive hardback book.
That is impressive.
Yeah.
But we're not here to talk about glorious yet, you know, whatever sci-fi. We're here to talk about games.
Yeah, that's because this is Game Store Profits.
One would think. I mean, we bothered to put it in the name.
Yes, sir. glorious board games.
I can say that as far as stuff that I've been able to play lately, it hasn't been much. Everything has been kind of in hiatus because I don't know if you've realized this, we've kind of had a bit of snow.
Yes.
Literally, as I'm recording this, I'm days away from getting, I can't believe I'm saying this, more snow.
Well, this is our 22nd winter.
Yeah.
We hit mud spring down here, and now we're getting ready to go back into the wet season.
I think my favorite meme that has come out of this entire thing is, I think it was one of those things, it was a picture of a chalkboard outside of a bar somewhere or something like that. And it pretty much just said, this spring is basically like winter, leaves the room angry, only to come back and say, and one more thing.
Yeah, I think my favorite one so far was the groundhog saying, you know, 4 more weeks of winter, and then, except for you, Tennessee, do your own thing.
Nice.
Because, I mean, you know, I think it was February, we had like an entire week of 80 degrees.
That's insane to me. No, I've been keeping track because my mother had some kind of bizarre superstition about the number of storms we were supposed to get. And we're way past that. I think we're at 14 distinct storms this year.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I will tell you, my neighbors are getting ready to sell their house. If you just want to move down here, it's really nice.
You can get in line. You can get in line. I think Brent Brown owns the rights to ask for me to move to his neck of the woods.
Well, you realize that the house on the other end of that is for sale too, so Brent can just move on down too.
Brent has been trying to get me to move to Boise, Idaho since I met the man. And I got to tell you, he has some amazing toys, so it's tempting.
Yeah, well, just think of all the D&D hijinks and board game hijinks we get into.
There we go. But because of the weather-related shenanigans in the Perna residence, I have been sparse in my ability to play board games. So pretty much the only games I've been able to play are ones that I can play with my wife. Mm-hmm. And if you've been playing our home game, you realize that there are few and far between board games that my wife actually enjoys.
But could this also go into our once and only section of our podcast that's coming back every week?
You mean the archive dive?
Yes, the archive dive.
We can, actually. I can't talk about the one game because I've already mentioned it in the archive dive. It's Castles of Burgundy. But that's not the only game that Susan really appreciates that has been around for a number of years now. And I actually had to double check because it seemed like the one game that she really enjoyed that we just played recently, I thought that it was more recent than this. And now granted, it's hardly like, you know, a decade old or anything, but it has a number of years behind it. It is from the good people of Portal Games. It is Tides of Time.
Yes. I do own this game, and I've played it many times.
Now, I will say, before I go into what Tides of Time is for the home audience, do you have Tides of Time or the Tides of Madness, which is the Cthulhu, the obligatory Cthulhu variant.
Now I have to go buy Tides of Madness, but no, I have Tides of Time.
Tides of Time, in case you have never heard of this game, if you like two-player games, if you like Sushi Go, but you're like, gosh, I really enjoy Sushi Go, but it's kind of basic, pick up Tides of Time, because Tides of Time is basically Sushi Go with much nicer artwork and a little bit more complicated scoring.
No, wait a minute. I like Sushi Go's artwork.
Now, Sushi Go's artwork is cute, don't get me wrong. It has its place. But Sushi Go is like little chibi food products. And Tides of Time, if you blew these up full size, would be the kind of thing you'd want to hang on your wall.
Okay, all right.
But anyway, Tides of Time is a drafting game. It's a straight-up two-player drafting game. You have a set of cards. You draft them. You give them back and forth. And you're dealing with all the normal stuff of drafting games. But there's a couple different things that kind of set Tides of Tide up. One, it's incredibly short. A full game does not take long. So if you're looking for a game that's just really easy to just sit down on the table and just really quickly play a bunch of games and just have a low-key, awesome time, Tides of Time is amazing. Another thing that Tides of Time does is that I really like the different scoring mechanisms because they do a lot of interesting things. Like, it's not just one type of thing, like have the most of this or have sets of this. There are different options. It's like, it's all different suits, and I'd explain them, but basically without the iconography in front of you, it would just be me saying weird things. But there are a bunch of different suits, and it's things like if you have the most of a certain suit, you'll get these points. Or if you have the most different types of suits, you'll have these points. Mm-hmm. But then they even throw in some other ones that says if you've received the most points from one single card, you get these points. And so it gives you a lot of really interesting things to do rather than just simple set collection. It gives you the ability to really kind of plan out some cool stuff, especially because of the really unique thing and why the word time is in this game. Because the game is played across three rounds. And each round is basically kind of like an era of this kind of land that you're playing in, that's depicted on the cards. And across each round, you get to keep one card that remains in play. So basically you are picking one card that gets to stick around and go into the next round with you. You're not drafting it. You're not having to worry about whether or not you're going to have it. It just sits there right there. It's your artifact from the previous age. And so I really like Tides of Time because at its core, it is incredibly simple. It is just like Sushi Go in the fact that it's a simple drafting game where there isn't much to it. But it provides these really interesting twists that kind of elevate it, in my mind, above Sushi Go. The weakness is that this is just two players. Unless you're a person who is recently been trapped in one place with just one other person like I have, then its strong point is the fact that it's only two players.
Well, you know, sometimes you only just need one other person.
It's true. But yeah, basically I've been playing that. I've been playing Castles of Burgundy, which is a phenomenal game. I really enjoy the heck out of that, which is interesting because it was the first kind of Euro-style game that got my attention because I am a theme junkie. And honestly, this game could be anything. This game could literally be anything. There is no theme to this whatsoever. It's part rolling dice, part, you know, just straight up Euro point salad. It's good. It's a fun time. And I'm one who enjoys the slight bit of randomness that you can mitigate with the use of workers and stuff. So I really love it. The fact that it's Susan's like favorite game ever is a bonus.
Well, I haven't played a dang thing. And I have to say it that way. I did play Putt-Putt. That's about it.
Well, that's not nothing.
But yeah, I've been busy with my contract ending and starting a new job and all that stuff, and planning a D&D campaign for about 20 something people.
I was about to say, you need to drop this information about the board, the D&D with the Boy Scouts, because it's the Boy Scouts, right?
Yeah, yeah. So we were at the beginning of the year, we sit down and we plan out what we're doing for the majority of the year. And I was sitting there taking notes while the senior patrol leader was, who plays Pathfinder. This kid's like the biggest nerd I know. So we're sitting there, I'm taking notes, and he's up there writing down, and then he just looks around the room trying to come up with new ideas, and he looks at me and goes, I think we need to have Daniel run us through a D&D campaign. Everybody vote on this, and everybody but my daughter voted yay.
I'm not surprised by this at all.
So, and I was like, well, I'll have to have some time to plan it. And they originally planned it for Memorial Day weekend. I'm like, no, we can't play this on Memorial Day weekend, but... So I've already got a list of scouts. I've actually got parents that are wanting to play now. So what we're going to do is I'm going to break the kids up into three groups. And I'm going to have two other DMs with me. And we're all going to run them through the same module, because we all have different styles of running the game. And we're going to do different systems. We're going to use Pathfinder, which will be my buddy Jason. 5th edition, which will be my buddy Chuck, who went with me to GaryCon. And last but not least would be me, running Castles and Crusades. And they're all D&D derivatives. You know, as Pathfinder is what they call 3.75. Castles and Crusades, a lot of people said that should have been the real 4th edition, which was the last thing worked on by Gary Gygax, and, of course, 5th edition.
So now, are you going to have kids go in between the different games to experience the different systems, or is it literally just, you have been chosen to play in the Pathfinder game, and
we're going to let them pick, because we do have some Pathfinder players already in the scout troop. So if they want to go and just play Pathfinder, or if they just want to try something new because that's all they know. But yeah, I figured we'll just, you know, go with the whole campaign. And if somebody else wants to try something later down the road, then we'll set something else up.
And now, are you going to do a published module, or are you guys writing something up for this?
I'm thinking about digging down into the archives of the wonderful internets and grabbing something from a Dragon magazine of days gone by. I just got to find out which module. It's going to be a one shot, so it's going to be something that can't last longer than 4 hours.
Right.
Because at 4 hours at that age, I'm just going to lose them.
Yeah. No. I think that it's going to be. I'm going to say it's going to be interesting.
Yes.
I think it'll be especially interesting based on the fact that you're going to have them running it in different systems.
Yes.
I am definitely interested in how that works out, because
we're going to have a recap on it, and I might even get some interviews with the other DMs to see how the kids reacted to them. And
we need to make that happen. That needs to be a thing.
But the only thing I'm lacking right now is dice. Yes, I said it. I'm lacking dice.
The irony is palpable in that statement.
Yes. So, I mean, you know, just to have enough dice for everybody and things like that. So, I mean, you know, if anybody out there listening wants to donate me some wonderful dice just for these Boy Scouts, in which they will be given to the Boy Scouts, I will not keep these dice, then I'll be okay with that.
Out of the kindness of your heart.
Yeah, selfless plug there. Oh, selfless plug there.
Selfless plug. I love it. Of course it is. All right. There is something that we need to discuss. There was part of me that when we started thinking about, okay, what are we going to do for the archive dive? There's part of me that wanted to go back. Because
are we talking about space babies and robots?
No, but we can come back to that, because that sounds amazing. No, I'm talking about a game that dominated my childhood.
HeroQuest?
No, but you're in the right era.
Monopoly.
You shut your mouth. Okay, before Daniel spends the next, 15 minutes just harassing me, it's Fireball Island. Fireball Island, I'm just going to say it. It is way better in my remembrance of Fireball Island than it actually was. Fireball Island was basically a roll and move in which you played as little adventurers that moved across this island. Your goal was to get up to the top of the island next to a statue. There was a jewel at the statue, and you had to run up, get the jewel, and run back to get off the island. The coolness and the toy factor of Fireball Island was at the top of the island next to the jewel was this statue. And this statue could basically be rotated around the map, and you would literally put a red marble representing a fireball into that statue and flick it down the board. And if that fireball hit you, you go back to the beginning of the map. That was the extent of the original Fireball Island.
Now, what a lot of people don't know is the new one is being made by Restoration Games.
Yes.
Which are renowned for their ability to rewrite rules to make a crappy, I wouldn't say crappy game, a game that was not as great as it could be, better.
It basically, they have taken games that, like on their website, they have a form that you can fill out that says, what's an old game of the past that you have a passionate love for, but wasn't all that great when compared to modern design trend? Literally, the moment they put that form up, I was on there saying, please, please, for the love of God and all things holy, remake Fireball Island. When I interviewed a couple of the people from Restoration Games, universally, they said it was literally everything else that they've ever been recommended, and then head and shoulders above any of them was Fireball Island. So, needless to say, when they announced it, I can't remember if it was at PAX or if it was at Gen Con, but it was on the Dice Tower, and they announced that they were going to do Fireball Island, and I may have audibly squeed.
I do believe that was the last Gen Con, wasn't it? When you send me a text message and said, go to this booth right here and pick up this whatever, which should be in your hand soon.
Oh, yeah. They had, a postcard or something from Fireball Island.
Yes.
Yes. No, that actually, well, you're right. It was Gen Con, because I did remember saying, oh my goodness, you need to make this happen for me. But yeah, there are some cool things that they've done with this Kickstarter. And I'm going to talk about the Kickstarter just in general for a second, but I kind of want to break down some of the things that it's not that they just took this 3D molded piece of plastic from my youth and made it again. As awesome as that would be, no one's buying that game because, again, you can only go so far on nostalgia. And it really is a straight roll and move garbage game. So some of the things that they've added to kind of tweak it and make it more interesting for modern gaming, some of it is very, very mechanical in the fact that the statue used to just have the one kind of path. You would literally flick the fireball out and it would roll straight out the mouth. Mm-hmm. Now it can potentially go from one of three different kind of routes out of the statue. So that's cool. It gives a little bit more randomness, a little bit more interesting kind of outcome there. You can play cards, which the other game did not have any kind of card, and those cards can do things like move your guy. It can kind of change things around the island. It can let you use shortcuts, that kind of stuff. You can get bonus points with them. So there's a lot of cool things going on with card play that wasn't in the original game. There are things like, one of the cards says that you can twist these trees. There are actually little three-dimensional trees now, which there weren't in the original game. Or I don't think there were. It's hard because it's like any nostalgia thing, you're going to misremember it. But There are trees, and those trees now can kind of direct the fireball as if the fireball hit the tree and moved off in a different direction. So there definitely is an interesting kind of fun factor to this. It's also bigger and crazier. Like, literally the size is bigger. So I've often said that one thing that will propel a game forward in my mind is its table presence. If somebody on the other side of the room looks at your table and go, oh my goodness, what the heck are those guys playing? That means something to me. And all you have to do is look up the Restoration Games version of Fireball Island to realize that it's kind of hard to miss. So, the reason that we're bringing this up is not just because I wanted to gush nostalgically about the horrible games of my youth, but also the fact that anytime a board game Kickstarter happens that raises $1 million,
that's not a cool mini or not game.
Oh yeah, it is not a cool mini or not game. I mean, the closest thing to any kind of miniature factor in this, other than the fact that it's a 3D molded board, is unlike the first one you were all just generic adventurer A. This one, the actual figures that you play are unique characters. But it's next to nothing. It's like four or five little characters.
Yeah.
So the fact that this game has banked so hard on nostalgia and has cashed out tremendously. It's got a long time left for this Kickstarter to go. I think it only just started recently. I think it only just started a couple days ago. And it's already at $1 million.
It's sad. I want $1 million.
Well, you could have obtained the rights to Fireball Island.
No, I'm going to get the rights to HeroQuest. And I'm gonna redo HeroQuest.
I believe, like, you could get four or five games that have already done that.
Well, yeah, but still.
But still.
No, nobody's called it HeroQuest yet, though.
But, I don't know. Daniel, you said that you did not play this when you were a kid.
Yeah, I've never even heard of it until you mentioned it to me.
Now, I can sit here, and this is interesting to me, because had I $60, I would have literally minute one have been getting this game. If I had that money available to me right now, it would be on this game. And I fully acknowledge that it is gimmicky, it is silly, and I would probably only play it a couple times, but I would still want it on my shelf. I'm curious, as a guy who does not have that nostalgia factor, in fact, I believe it was TR who got in on the tavern when I posted that Fireball Island was live, and he goes, as a guy who didn't play this, I don't see what all the fuss is about. I'm curious. And as a person who has never played the original game, who does not have the nostalgia backing, does anything about this game look interesting to you?
Not for $60.
What would make it like a 60? Like, what do you? What is either turning you away, or what?
They've got the nostalgia thing for you. I mean, there's no nostalgia in it for me at all. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I'd play it. Yeah, I'd give it a go. I mean, it looks fun. It looks like something that would be a good kids game. But, I mean, you know, there's a skill. Usually it's one of those games where, like, okay, let me explain this. You know how people get mad at dice rolls because dice rolls can affect a game, and yet they're like, well, you can't have skill in this game.
Oh, I know a ton of people who basically will outright refuse to play a game if it has dice in it.
Well, I mean, you're at the whim of a marble going down, just being shot through this demon head. Down this little ramp.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, it's random. I mean, But and then you got the card draw and things like that. So there may not be any skill, but I don't know. I've never played it before. But I mean, it looks cool. Don't get me wrong, it looks cool, but I wouldn't pay $60 for it. I'd wait for it to get out at Gen Con and then a couple months later get it for about $25 on Amazon.
See, that's one thing that is getting at me right now. Like, as much as I realize that I am the target demographic of this game, I do wonder how many people who, after they've obtained it and have sat down with it a couple times, are like, and I'm done with this.
Well, it's like that those games we played when we were kids that were really gimmicky, that, you know, it's like the Pie Face game. You know, it's our Pie Face game. You know, my kids, oh, let's play the Pie Face game. Let's play the Pie, because it was advertised very well. So, and yeah, I'm comparing something to your youth to the Pie Face game. And you know, this is, you know, our Pie Face games are something that were a little bit more intricate than our kids' Pie Face games. But, you know, I had HeroQuest, and you had Fireball Island, and you know, I had Mutant Chronicles and stuff like that. But, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know how any other way to put it.
It'll be interesting to see how this kind of goes once the... Cause, I mean, I'm convinced that this game had to come out on Kickstarter. Because if Restoration Games just said, we're releasing Fireball Island for $60, I don't think it would have sold as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of tooling that people don't realize in production of things, especially injection molded things, that there's a lot of tooling that goes along. Like, and they're probably, a lot of people are like, well, they're going to make a lot of money. Well, yeah, but they're going to have to pay a lot of money to get parts made and stuff like that. So it's not like they can go back in the Wayback Machine and get the original tools that were probably destroyed. They're having to recreate all this on their own.
Well, even if they had access to the originals, they changed the board.
Well, yeah. I mean, but that's the thing, though. I mean, there's a lot of production that sort of go into this and things. I mean, it looks really good. I mean, I would get it for the kids if it wasn't so expensive.
Yeah. I think that there's a couple of reasons this would still kind of, you know, ring my proverbial bell. Part of it is the nostalgia, and part of it is for the ministry, because, again, I gravitate towards games that people who have no idea what the heck a board game is sees it and goes, what is this and why am I not playing it already?
Now, I think the story and the artwork look amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. I love that picture on the box of the girl running from the fireball. I mean, I just like stuff like that. I think it's really pulpy and it looks awesome. I love pulp artwork, you know, pulp fiction, things like that. And I think that goes really well.
Yeah, the production is head and shoulders above the original, okay. Mostly because the original was a mass market, you know, blatantly for kids, you know, ripoff game. Like it was made in the age when board games were for kids, in the fact of it doesn't have to be good. We just have to distract the children for a couple, you know, for a half hour.
Hence Monopoly. But sorry, I always take a jab at Monopoly whenever I get a chance to.
But I think that, you know, it's interesting. And I do want to bring up a couple other things that are going on there, because I don't even think that Pat fully appreciated when he was saying this. Pat Lysite from Kara Games got up there, and once Fireball Island got announced, as you guys probably know, they are currently running the Kickstarter for Soul of the Empire, which is their game that they're just putting out right now. And Soul of the Empire, it has funded, which is great. It was super good news to see that it is funded. But literally, the second Fireball Island's Kickstarter went up, like, a ton of people backed out of Soul of the Empire.
That's sad.
And obviously, there's going to be some people who back out just because, you know, stuff happens. I've done that. I've backed out of Kickstarter saying, whoops, thing, you know, something changed in my life and I can't afford this right now.
Yeah.
So you allow for some of that. But, like, he's like, Fireball Island hit, whoosh, like giant just exodus. And I have mixed feelings about this, because there is part of me that's like, well, I mean, what are you going to do, man? You can't, you know, people only have so much money and they're going to go for that. The only reason I bring that up is, one, because there will be, by the time this goes up, I think there will be like a couple days left in that Kickstarter. Yeah. So if you're listening to this and you haven't backed it, please go back it, because there are a lot of stretch goals that they want to add to that game that will make the overall experience of playing it much better. But it is funded. It is funded. But the other thing I kind of just, I don't know, there's part of me that just feels like I want to see how much of this is gimmick.
Yeah. And that's what I feel like, that a lot of people are going to have buyer's remorse when they get Fireball Island. They're going to play it a couple times, and then eventually it's just going to end up on a shelf.
And I'll say it right now, if somebody who gets it gets that buyer's remorse, I will gladly have it for our game days, because, like I said, it will have that table presence that I love. Yeah. So,
oh, yeah.
So even if it ends up being on my shelf of games I only keep around for Inroads-related game days, I would do that.
It'll attract your kids, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
Kids love that.
It'll just be interesting. But in a world where Soul of the Empire exists, in a world where what Plaid Hat just announced Starship Samurai, which looks amazing.
Yeah, and I'm mad at you for sharing that link. It's just
Starship Samurai looks ridiculous in all the best ways. And the fact that it's designed by Isaac Vega, who's one of my favorite designers. It looks so good. It looks so good. And I'm hoping, I don't know, they didn't show up to PAX Unplugged last year, but if they're at PAX Unplugged this year, you best believe I'm going to go and check it out, because I want to see it.
That's cool.
All right. This does kind of lead into another topic that I want to bring up, which I think it was a fascinating bit of internet sociology that I got to witness. The folks over at Board Game Blitz, which is a phenomenal podcast, by the way, in case you're interested. Basically, they're in a lot of ways, they're just another amazing review podcast for board games, but they're only a half hour long, and they just do a really, really good job. And I gotta say that on their Twitter, they asked a really good question. I think it's Crystal that runs their Twitter, but they got on there and said, "Hey, for our next episode, we have a question for you." And then this was word for word what they said: "What makes a game objectively bad?"
I can give you an example right now. If Patrick Lysaght doesn't hit 13,000 on his Kickstarter, and it's linen cards, man. You can't go wrong with linen. I can't stand cards that don't have a linen finish. And I mean, I'll play games with them, but they just get wore out really quick.
Well, I actually ended up responding to that one, and a lot of the things that I did was all about component quality. I was saying things that make a bad game are unbalanced dice, cards that disintegrate, you know, spinners that don't work, like any of the stuff that literally does not function the way it's supposed to, that makes a game objectively bad. But here's the thing, though. Twitter lets you see everyone else's response, not just yours. So I'm like, oh, I'm dying to see what other people are saying. And yes, while I was not even kind of the only person who had actually objective things to point out that would make a game bad, so many people were responding to what makes a game objectively bad with incredibly subjective things. They were saying things like, any game that doesn't give me any meaningful choice. And I'm looking at this tweet going, I want you to define objective for me, because what you say is objectively wrong is nothing but a subjective answer, because what on earth constitutes a meaningful choice? Now, I can define that for myself. I know what I think is a interesting choice, but that's literally the textbook definition of subjective when I have to provide the definition for what that is. So the thing that really got me going on this, the thing that made me think about this and why I wanted to bring it up on our podcast, other than to say that the folks at Board Game Blitz are awesome and you should listen to them, is just that notion of the fact that so many of these people, and I don't want to say that just because in this particular instance, I had the more common sense to literally say, okay, this makes objectively bad and those things are subjective. I do this to a lot of other things too. But what I've discovered is that so many times we think that just because we have a definition in our head and that we have a firm ruling of what a thing is, that clearly everyone has that same thought in their head, that everyone has that same kind of situation to them. Like, everyone must agree with us because clearly it is the right way.
Yeah, I mean, if everybody agreed with me, we'd burn every copy of Monopoly.
Well, that's not what happened. That's the thing. Like I'm going to say we joke. I think I joke more than you do.
Yeah.
About how bad Monopoly is. Like, I literally have an article on our site called "I Hate Monopoly."
Now, how many copies do you have in your house?
One. I have one copy.
I have three.
I have one copy. That I had to get donated because there was every time we do TavernCon especially, but every time we run a big, large-scale game day, there's always somebody that says, do you have Monopoly? And I did not want to spend the $20 on a copy of Monopoly, so I put out a call for donations and somebody gave me a copy.
I have the original Monopoly that my parents used to play with me, sitting on the shelf back here. I hide it. I have my Star Wars Monopoly that I got in 1995. I've only played it once. And I'll tell you the one thing missing from it's the dice. Cause I took them out
for D&D. Yeah, cause you swiped them.
Yeah. And then my son for Christmas got Stranger Things Monopoly. Cause he loves Monopoly. It's his favorite game of all time.
And that right there proves it. Like, I can argue about all the ways that Monopoly is a terrible game. And I say that because I have. I have literally had that discussion with people about how Monopoly is an objectively bad game. I've said that before.
Yes.
But it isn't actually an objectively bad game. It is a subjectively bad game. I really dislike it. But that does not necessarily mean, okay, one thing I will clarify because everybody who's listening to this will respond to it in the comments. When played by the actual rules,
Monopoly, not the house rules.
When played by the actual rules, Monopoly is not an objectively bad game. It is, however, not a good game in my opinion.
Well, and if you look in the Stranger Things Monopoly rulebook, the first rule is play by the actual rules. Don't play by your house rules. It actually says that.
See, I appreciate that. I appreciate when a game identifies its own trope. But just I want to spend time in that space, especially in regards to like faith and the way we handle other people and all that stuff. The second I started seeing these responses, I'm just like, these people are not stupid people.
No.
They're not dumb people. They just actively think that what they think is the truth. It is absolutely 100% objective. It is clear and concise and cannot be argued that what they think is a bad thing must actually and for always be a bad thing.
Oh, yeah. But it's, I mean, it's just, it's their opinion. They think that once they explain their reasoning to you, you'll be the same as them. And it's not the same. No, you can't push your opinion on anybody like that.
Well, here's one recently. It's not gaming related, but it is kind of pop culture-y. And here's a plug for you. It's going to be significantly mentioned in the next episode of Bard and Bible. I recently sat down to watch The Greatest Showman, which is
okay.
Hugh Jackman playing P.T. Barnum, and it's a full on musical number. It's intense and crazy and insane, and I loved every minute of it. Mm-hmm. I literally finished. I didn't even finish before it was even over. I said, this is one of my favorite movie going experiences I've had in the recent past. And a friend of mine immediately jumped on that and said, I really didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. And I said, okay, why didn't you like it? And she had two reasons. One, she kind of just agreed with something that I said. It is straight up musical in that it goes from music number to music number to music number to music number.
A lot of musicals.
And it doesn't spend a lot of time filling in the blanks between musical numbers. In fact, whole years of time pass from the beginning of some musical numbers to the end of that musical number. So I'm like, okay, I totally get how that can be annoying. Because there are times when I'm like, oh, these two are a couple? When did that happen? Oh, I guess that happened in the period between this song and the last song. But I was able to overlook that. The other thing that she mentioned was that she, like, P.T. Barnum is a terrible man.
Oh, yeah.
And this movie puts him out as, like, this redeemable, remarkable hero. And I'm like, and she's like, if you know the story of P.T. Barnum, you can't do that to him. And I go, I know the story of P.T. Barnum probably better than most, because I have an almost unnatural appreciation for all things circus, and especially the sideshow, which was P.T. Barnum's pretty much his invention. And as a guy who has spent a lot of time reading a lot of books and looking into a lot of the histories, I can tell you that I believe the way I described it to her was P.T. Barnum was a great man, but he was certainly not a good man. And I'm having this whole conversation with her, and we're discussing and we're looking at all this different stuff. And she's going, these are the many reasons why I don't like it. This, 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 and this. And I can look at her and go, I totally get that you don't like those things. And they're totally valid as reasons not to like this movie. But I freaking love this movie.
But it's no High School Musical.
I can't remember what. It was actually on an episode of Flip the Table, which sadly is a podcast that is no longer with us. But the backlog is still there, and Flip Flory also does a new podcast on. I think it's like Flip Flory's Saturday Cereal or something. If you look up Flip Flory on your podcatcher of choice, you'll find it. But there was a way they describe certain games that they'd play. If you don't know what Flip the Table is, one, fix that now, fix it immediately. Two, they took old, terrible, awful games that have no business being board games, and they play them. They play games like Gone Birding, which is a VCR bird-watching game. Oh, it's one of the greatest episodes known to man. But, like, there were times when they would play these games and they'd be like, this is just awful, it's trash, this is the worst experience, I can't believe you made us do this. But then there were other games that they would sit back and go, this is not a good game, but it's a really good game. Like, they would look at it and go, there is nothing about this that should make it good, but I loved every moment of it. And they said that to a number of games over the time they did that podcast. And that immediately strikes me about this. The idea that two people can look at the exact same thing and have vastly different responses to it. And some of it actually defies objectivity. It actually looks in the face of objectivity and spits in its eye. Because you could make arguments that certain games and certain things are objectively bad, but at the same point, you love them. Like that phenomenon is fascinating to me. And I think it's especially unique from our perspective, coming from the whole aspect of faith, because we deal in the fact that there is such a thing as objective reality, objective truth. There is one truth, and it is God.
Right.
So there is this element where we want to be like, oh yes, there is objective truth. There is complete and absolute perfect truth. And I think that is what connected me to this tweet from the folks at Board Game Blitz, because I can see this happening in a faith perspective. If you take it away from board games and you posted that tweet onto like especially if it's like some kind of like reformed forum, be like what makes a theology objective truth? And I'm pretty confident that at least half the answers will be some kind of subjective, this is why this has to be true. Because everybody thinks that their rendition of how God functions has to be how God functions.
Yeah, and and if you ever look at people's reasoning behind, well, I don't go to church because of this. I don't go do this because of this happened to me. It's all subjective. You know, it's just like, you know, I don't go to church because of hypocrites. Well, not everybody's a hypocrite. But yet, you want to lump everybody in there. You know, you can get subjective even then to that point.
I love this idea of having two people see the exact same thing and have vastly different responses to it. Because we do this with scripture all the time.
Right.
I've seen people literally use the same proof text both for an opinion and against the same opinion. And it's the same verse. Recently, there was a, you know, I think it was in Theology Gaming. It was one of the gaming / religion forums that I'm a part of on Facebook. I think it was Theology Gaming. And in the course of talking about the various stuff that we were going through in Theology Gaming, somebody mentioned the book of 1 Corinthians. And they were just walking through just some of the different things that 1 Corinthians, and even 1 and 2 Corinthians bring up. These are passages that you're talking about, like the head coverings and different stuff like that. The stuff that, you know, I wish we didn't spend so much time on, but we spend so much time on.
A little nitpicking thing.
Right. And we were talking about that, and people were just bringing like, okay, I think it means this, and I'm curious about this, and cultural stuff, and this and that. And I'm reading all this, and at some point, I had to do what I always do when somebody starts getting into the nitpicky stuff, specifically of 1st and 2nd Corinthians. I go, Paul's letters to the Corinthians were primarily about unity of the body.
Right.
He was addressing issues in that church to promote unity amongst the believers. And the irony of that is that I personally have not seen any one book of the Bible used more divisively than 1st and 2nd Corinthians. Because of the fact that he brings up all these nitpicky little cultural religious stuff and how that, you know, how that should work. A book that is its literal written purpose is to promote unity of the believers has been used to split. I can't tell you how many churches. The irony is palpable.
Yeah, I mean, I've literally had people tell me before, I won't go to your church because your women do not wear head coverings when you worship.
I don't comprehend that.
I'm like, well, your head's not shaved. You know, I mean, I don't get it. I mean, to me, it's like eating a bowl of rice and complaining about one grain.
Yeah.
You won't eat it because there's one brown speck of rice versus white rice. And to me, just flick that out and don't even worry about it because the main story is told there, salvation. And you know, salvation's the important part. You know, and if God convicts you to start wearing head coverings, then wear head coverings, but don't make everybody else do it. But yet, and I'm not going to rail on head coverings, but it's just those things, those little bitty things that people, for some reason, are drawn to that they can just pick out and be like, well, you don't do this. I'm like, so.
Yeah, and it's really, it boggles my mind. Every time I look at this stuff, I'm convinced that it's really, really fascinating to me that this happens over and over and over again. This, what I believe is such piddling garbage is so incredibly pivotal to another person's faith, apparently.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that so many times we trip over our own feet in attempting to be this thing, this ideal person, this, you know, follow every minute rule, we completely overlook huge swaths of what it means to be a person of faith.
I'll complain about that all day long.
Well, I do say something. I mean, like, we're not here just to rampantly complain, but at the same point, I think that this happens too much for us to not at least bring it up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that really gets me about this is they dig too much into church history, and yeah, you have to take the books in the Bible as the reason why they were written. Okay, you know, the things that Timothy went through as being a very young pastor. He was, what, 18, 19 years old when he was leading his first church. You know, in there it says that, you know, Paul tells him to tell the women not to speak during service. The reason being is they would interrupt him while he was preaching, you know, to ask questions. And he, you know, pretty much like, hey, stop. Ask me later. Let me get through my point. This is God speaking. And yet some people, and especially in the South, are like, well, women shouldn't do that. Women shouldn't be an authority over a church group.
Yep.
Yeah. All they can do is teach Sunday school for kids. No. No. I've seen women pastor churches, and I've seen women pastor churches well, even though I am a non-denominational, almost Baptist, and they do not agree of women pastoring churches, and I'm not trying to be this to be sexist, but you know, I've seen it in Nicaragua. I've seen it in other countries. And here in the States, I've listened to many of a woman preach, and God has spoke to me through that. And there's no reason why women can't do that. It's just because, one, men, they need to get out of the way a little bit on this. And two, it's like, why did they say that in the first place?
Well, I brought this up a lot of times before on this podcast and the other podcasts, and even when I'm just talking, you know, on my own stuff. There's an element that has to come into this. Because, you know, people listen to this and be like, oh, you don't think that there's some kind of objective truth, that there's a, you know, and I'm like, no, I do. I 100% believe. I'm not one of those people who's going to bust out, you know, only Sith steal in absolutes. I'm not that guy. Which is really fun because I've actually had that conversation with Star Wars nerds saying that yes, in the Star Wars universe, I would probably be a Sith because I do believe in absolutes.
Right. And at one point I was that way. Okay. God has changed me. We used to have this outreach pastor at my old church, and her thing would be, well, Daniel, everything's not black and white. There's gray in the world. And I would look at her, I said, but the words we live by are written in black and white.
Dang! That's like old school t-shirt Christianity right there.
That's what I was at one point in my life.
That is old school cheesy youth group t-shirt Christianity.
Yeah, and like, you know, I've had to change my ways because of that. You know, because I had to realize there's gray points in the world, and that if you look, Jesus brought the gray. Jesus gave us a way to deal with the gray, and that's grace.
Well, and my favorite thing to bring up is the fact that, yes, God is perfect truth. God is holy and righteous, and everything that he say is exactly how it's supposed to be. God is holy. The Bible is inspired and inerrant. Here's the thing. I'm neither of those.
Right. Me either.
So me reading that, I cannot give those same words my reading of those words. That just because those words are inspired, that text is inerrant, does not mean that my reading of it is without error or that my reading of it is automatically from God. And so, so much of why I wanted to bring this up with us here on this podcast is just that. It's to call forth that level of humility. I've done it on Bard and Bible a bunch of times. I will continue to do it. I will continue to make that a thing. Because so much of what I think gets under people's skin when it comes to church folk, and I'm not even talking about people outside of the church, I'm talking about other people from other denominations. I think the reason we all get under each other's skin is because we all think that our version has to be exactly what God wants. And, yeah. And there's a level of humility that has to come alongside that and says, but I could be completely wrong.
Well, and I'll tell you this. I grew up in a church that said if you were not of this denomination and believed this way, no matter if you received Christ in your life or not, you were going to hell.
See, that's ludicrous.
I know, and I do not believe that now. I you know, God even showed me a vision of that one time when I was 18. And I'm sorry, I'm getting into visions. I literally prayed about this, and you know, at one point God showed me that there were going to be people of other versions of Christianity in heaven. But yet I have family members that tell me on a day-to-day basis, your family's going to hell because you're not this and you're that.
That's insane. Yeah. I've said it before and I'll say it again. There are many, many cool aspects about the community that we've fostered here, and I continue to just be amazed and humbled by the fact that y'all like us and hang around us.
But we're weird.
But, but like, you have no idea how many times I will just straight up floor people when I say I can get a Pentecostal, a Baptist, a Methodist, a Lutheran. I can get every one of them with an atheist, a pagan, I can get all of them at the same table. And they're like, how does that happen?
Magic.
The gathering. We bring it out.
Yes, that's it right there.
But, you know, we joke about that, but like the fact that that happens, a lot of people don't understand that.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't comprehend that this happens, but it happens in the tavern daily, and it's because of the fact that I think that this community has brought together this understanding of, yes, God is truth, God is amazing, and God is perfect, but I am not, and therefore I will work hard to come up with what I think is the right answer, but I will not hold it so tightly that I will automatically think that everything you say is worthless.
That is true.
I think every one of us, holds to that, and I really hope that becomes more and more of a thing. Like, I want us to foster this in the places we go out to, especially in the churches that we go to. The idea that so many different denominations with so many, let's just call it like it is. I mean, yeah, we all come to the same table when it comes to the pillars of faith that kind of declare, like, this is what orthodoxy is. But at the same point, there are so many vastly different interpretations of doctrine, so many vastly different understandings of scripture within these church traditions, yet every one of us comes to the same table to play these games and to talk right. about stuff, to share prayer requests, and to do all this stuff together because of the fact that we all acknowledge that we work really hard to understand God, but we also know that we're not him. And so maybe we need to cut each other a little slack.
Yeah. I just don't know where people get the fact that we have to build these walls.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what it is. It's what it boils down to. I mean, if you and I'll complain about, like, when the biggest churches in our area where I'm at, they build, like, pretty much walls around everything they do. You know, they've got their own gym, so their kids don't have to play basketball with other kids that are not of their church and things like that. I mean, it's just like, and I'm going somewhere with this, but that's the thing. We have to tear down these walls. That's the whole point of this ministry, is to tear down walls. I mean, if you boil down En-ROADS to what it is, our job is to find a way to tear down walls between other denominations, other people that don't assigned to our version of the religion, you know, people that are not religious, people that worship something completely different than what we worship. That's our job. It's to tear down the walls, not to convert, but to understand.
Yeah.
And to love on them, because that's what Christ did. Christ loved on people.
Well, if you look at our last episode, we ended up talking about how, yeah, we want people to find faith in Jesus. We wouldn't be doing this if we didn't want that to happen. But at the same point, our actions towards people, our relationships with people, are not relegated on whether or not they eventually make that choice. It's not that we build these relationships because we care and love people. And in the process, we hope that in the way that we communicate God, in the way that we demonstrate the love of God, that God will speak to that person. And yeah, in a way, a lot of that also applies to a lot of people's mentalities, even within the church, that we're not, you know, just saying, you know, like, oh, those crazy heathens, you know, there are a lot of people. I mean, there are people who look at, in fact, again, it was interesting because every once in a while I pop back into the Wayback Machine on Facebook where it says, like, 5 years ago this happened. And I can't remember how many years ago it was, but, like last week it had a post, like, of all these people saying how silly we were at En-ROADS or how we should put away the games and pick up our Bibles. That was on Reddit. Somebody said that about us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are people who think that objectively our ministry is nonsense. And I'm thankful that that's a subjective statement. I'm thankful that is something that is not, you know, so blatantly obvious and so well wrought that it is objectively true. I think that a lot of us need to step back and understand the definition of objective, because a lot of the time we are functioning in a very subjective manner when we think that we're being objective. All right. I think that sounds like a wonderful place to end this episode.
Yes. But, Mike, we always have to remember God is the game master. And however the dice may fall, the game must go on.